I got sober in prison, so it was early in the sentence. I changed myself and became a faith-believing guy. Yeah, and it wasn't because of the nick. Everyone went, "Oh, he's in the prison." It was because I was dying inside. I was 34 years of age. I was nicked with my father. I got 12 and a half years with my dad in the same cell for 2 years. My mother said on the first visit, "You're going to find out things about your dad that you don't like." And it was really strange because what I didn't like about my dad, I didn't like about myself.
I'm Paul Scolfort, and this is Powerful. In this series, I come clean about my own sobriety and the journey it took for me to get here. In each episode, I will speak to a special guest about their addictions and how they achieve sobriety and how they maintain a happy lifestyle today. Today, I'm really excited to talk to Michael Emmett, ex-gangster from London, author of Sins of Fathers. We discuss addiction, the hole in the soul, drug running across Europe, and relationships with fathers. So in some of these episodes, there will be discussions of alcohol misuse, drugs, sexual abuse, suicide, and some other heavy topics. So please take care when listening. Thank you, Michael, for coming to this podcast. I really appreciate your time.
Anything for you.
I'd love you to see
you, mate. Appreciate being here.
Before we start, I just want to do this, which I wouldn't usually do, but this book is amazing. Sins of Fathers. Where can people buy it? Where can our listeners buy it?
I think now, it's two or three. Amazon.
Yeah.
Amazon. It's been out for about 3 years now.
Yeah.
But yeah, Amazon or...
But it's funny, books, isn't it? Because my wife does her own books, writes her books, and then you get like bursts of people coming in, and some people don't find out, then they find out about it, and then you get another burst.
Yeah, it carries on.
It's a weird game.
Yeah, it's a funny game. And I think it's when you find out about it, because I think it spikes the ego, and you're a bit paranoid. Oh my God, have I done the right thing? And I think you run with it because, I've got a book. But I never felt like that. I just wanted it to be a message. It was a bit of a letter to say sorry to a number of people as well.
Yeah.
But, I enjoyed it. I promoted it. And it still does its thing, you know?
I think it's one of the books that can be there for years. Because it's great. It's a good story. There's some funny bits. I kind of cried at some bits, like welled up thinking, fuck, because I've experienced something similar internally. And other bits, it was like aha moments for me. And other bits, I was like, don't do that.
I know.
But I just want to say, we were touching before. The first time I saw you was at a friend's wedding, possibly 15 years ago.
About that.
And I just saw like this good-looking, tall, big fella, really strong, super confident. And the Toastmaster, bless him, was, I think, like ex-cop or ex-CID that you said worked at Maidstone. And he looked really intimidated.
Yeah.
And you just carried on doing this amazing speech to the groom that you met with balaclavas on, with guns by a truck.
Yeah.
And I just thought, who is this guy?
Yeah, I know.
But how
crazy.
Confident.
Crazy stuff. I feel, the confidence was sometimes a cover-up. I had a natural ability, I think. But where I was very broken and sort of damaged... sometimes the confidence was to cover up some, who I was and what you thought I was. But mainly, I think it was just my character as well.
But do you think, because I, with addiction, I experienced horrendous fear.
Mm.
And I learned to mask it with certain things. But did you know at the time that was fear and you was masking it? Or was this in hindsight because you've done a lot of work on yourself?
That's a good question. I suppose growing up, the conversation in my head was quite uncomfortable. It was always, I was never sort of satisfied. I was always looking for affirmation, this low self-worth, whatever it was. The name of the book is Sins of Fathers, because I do think that there's something that comes through from my grandfather, my dad, and myself. And we repeated the same behavior. It wasn't taught, it was in me. And I sort of was disjointed from the age of about 4 or 5. And then it was a cover-up. But when I was high, it was a bit of a buzz to it. But in the cold light of day, the noise in my head I didn't like.
Did you? I thought as a kid I had adrenaline problems, or it was always a drama. Something was going on. Yeah. I had some childhood trauma as well, which later come to bite me. And I realised in my 20s what it was, and I was running away from it.
Right.
And using alcohol really as a painkiller.
Mm.
But I didn't start drinking early. When did you discover drinking drugs?
Well, my father used to be a club owner, nothing like Peter Stringfellow's. It was an old gambling spiel and a drinker in Balham. So there was all, we used to live in the flats at Stockwell, and we had this little bar in the house with a few optics. And it was always people, yeah, it was always, never, we had a good childhood with my mum and dad, but it was always booze in the house. And if there was a little party, a Sunday night party, me and my sister used to wake up in the morning, and that smell of alcohol and the ashtray,
mm-hmm.
yeah? And I'd go to my sister, I mean, I can't remember, my mum told me, but I'd see my mum's lipstick, I love my mum, on her gin and tonic, which was, and I'd go, oh, it's mummy's drink. And I mean, I never used to get drunk, but the first time I got drunk was I was about 11.
So you waited for a long time.
Yeah, I waited 5 years. I waited five stretch. But the first time I did have a drink, I got absolute... There was a thing called party sevens and party fours. And it was 4 pints of bitter in these disgusting drinks. And I remember me and my mate going over the park, and we drank, four of us drunk pint each. And all I'd done was I ewed everywhere. I was so drunk.
Did you feel like... Because I really started to drink to fit in, but I didn't have an aha moment initially, like, oh, this is amazing. But I did start to feel like, oh, I feel different now I'm drinking. Like, this is, I feel a bit stronger,
yeah.
A bit funnier. The noise stopped in my head. Was that, did you, I know you got hammered, but did you feel different in a way? Or was it just a thing you did with the lads?
I just think it was a thing I did with the lads, but just to go back, you know, cards on the table, I had sexual abuse on me when I was about 5 or 6, yeah. And, all right, it wasn't absolutely outrageous, but it was more than doctors and nurses. And what happened, I don't think a child of my age should have been exposed to it.
Mm.
But bizarrely, it wasn't I sort of enjoyed in the end. It was weird. Not enjoyed, but it was like, it was a sensation, yeah? And it dysfunctional stuff. And sort of a, it was a babysitter, yeah? And I think that sort of contributed to the hole, the gaping hole, the sins of the, you know, the father of the, my father was a complete and utter lunatic, and my, bless his heart, and my mother was wonderful. So there was a yin and yang there for early days. And so as I got older, I think that first drinking thing wasn't attached to changing the way I felt. I really don't think that. But as I progressed and I started struggling in school, and I was a liar, it was like electric in me, you know? I excelled at sport. But when I started, I was frightened of drugs at first, especially cocaine. I was really frightened of it. And then I discovered cannabis. And then I discovered, once I discovered it, it was my armor. Mm. I used it constantly because I did feel different when I was on it. And I think the lie takes you away from reality.
Why was you scared? Because it's funny, I when I do shares and talks about that, I say that I weaned myself onto drinking drugs,
right.
Mainly because the strong men in my family or around my father, once they got drunk, was either fucking crying in a lap or they was fighting or some sort of thing happened or drama happened. And as a kid, found it really scary and intimidating.
Did you?
Yeah, I did. Yeah, my dad had he was from Canning Town, was a second generation docker, big guy, and had a rage on him that the dog would, when he came in, the dog would run out the back door and we knew then to leave the front room.
Right, okay.
It was like that. I was quite anxious as a kid and quite terrified, and I felt that, especially if he had a drink, I was just scared. And I didn't want to be like that, not to put my dad down, it wasn't all about him, but it was his associates as well.
Yeah.
So I was scared of being out of control. And I think now in hindsight, I realised I was quite controlling around myself.
Wow.
Because I was fearful of... I thought if you puffed, you'd start hallucinating. I had no idea about it.
Yeah.
So why are you scared of cocaine?
I think that I was... I think I inherited the fear. And I contributed. I think the sexual abuse made the gap bigger. And instead of it being, my mum was unconditional love. But I think there's a spiritual concept to this. I think, you know, children are, they say that the youth is wasted on the young, yeah? We have a real open insight to life, and I think we pick things up. But I inherited the fear, and it wasn't until I got to know my dad that I know that he had it as well. So it was a mixture of an opposite, completely fearless in my actions, as you know, but also fearful. So there would be a coward that turned up some days, and the following day, Tarzan would turn up. But I suppose growing up with my father, who we know about, was, you know, my father used to have a big car showroom over in Hendon, and people like Tarzan came there, the actor, and there was always these Diana Dawes and all these sort of Moody's, not Moody's, I don't mean that, but the celebrity things and all the gangsters. And I suppose I grew accustomed to it, but I was on point. My dad had 7 children, and my family, my sister was extremely bright, so was my brother, and I weren't. I was a street kid from day dot, and I think we lived on that. Fear can be a sort of something we live on as well, and it can drive us to where we want to be, but cocaine enhanced it to a paranoia of total disbelief.
Because when it's funny at that about the fear, isn't it? Because I end up making amends to my dad, and I told him that I was fearful of him, really scared. And he said to me, he said, actually, you made me scared sometimes.
Really?
Which completely blew me away. Yeah, and I think that was...
Did you ask him why, what he was frightened of?
No, there was a couple of times when...
Your looks?
Yeah, it was my knee.
Oh,
it was when I had shorts on. No, there was a point where one day he'd lost his temper about something and he'd raised his voice to my mum, and I think I was just tired of it, and I come downstairs and confronted him. It was the first time I confronted him, and I had zero fear because I'd run out of energy in that way. I just it was just resentment, and I just saw red. It's the first time I saw him see me. And that changed our dynamics for a long time. And I never stepped across the line. I always respected him. But I was gutted that it happened, but it had changed. So he saw that man in me then at 15, you know, and it had changed the dynamic, really. And I think since then we'd had a strained relationship.
Right.
Like, I love my dad, and I always want to be really friends with him. We do the best we do, but he's 83 from Canning Town, and he has a toolkit different from mine.
Absolutely.
You know, which I have to respect. But how long have you been sober now?
I got sober in prison, and then I relapsed. When I come out of prison, I relapsed for a year, and that was 24 years ago. So I've been clean of alcohol and Class A drugs for this May. I think it's 24 years this May.
That's amazing, isn't it?
Really amazing.
And how's your mindset now compared to, say, 2 years before you got sober?
Well, I got sober in prison, so it was... I'd sort of... Early in the sentence, I changed myself and became a faith-believing guy, yeah? And it wasn't because of the nick. Everyone went, he's in the prison. It was because I was dying inside. I was 34 years of age. I was nicked with my father. I got 12 and a half years with my dad in the same cell for 2 years.
How was that? That must be crazy.
My mother said on the first visit, you're going to find out things. I don't mean to disrespect my dad. I love him, bless his heart. Well, he's not here no more. But she said, you're going to find out things about your dad that you don't like. And it was really strange because what I didn't like about my dad, I didn't like about myself.
Yeah.
It was very... But he was a short Irish guy. He could fight like you can't believe. So it was all ego-based, but he was a shrewd nut. He was a professional criminal, but he was also very bright. But that fear in him, I used to see, and I thought, I got that. So that was difficult. But I suppose that's when we learn about the masks. You know, the drink, the drugs. I don't mean to be rude, there's ladies in the room, the sex, the love act, you know, the addiction to love. And then the the explosion of self, because there was no contentment. Nothing fixed me. That's why I became what I was in the faith.
And so there's two things, like in the recovery game, we talk about that hole in the soul, that disconnect that needs to be filled. And it's a genuine hollow feeling that something's not correct and right. When you had, I read in your book about you had that spiritual experience, which was quite phenomenal, actually.
Powerful.
Was that before you started in recovery? Was that that led you to come into recovery?
Led me. Well, I it was funny. In 1986, I got arrested, whatever, for some cocaine. And blah, blah, blah. Cut a long story short. Anyway, they never found it, and it was a whatever. And I get a bit of bow. So I went along to a dear friend of mine who's, I think, nearly 40 years sober now, whatever it was. And I went to her, listen, I need some help. She went, I'll come to the meeting. I wasn't looking for the meeting. I was looking for someone to go, no, you know, I wanted a few references, yeah? It was all graft. I went to my first meeting in about 87, I'm not sure, something like that. But I identified. And I didn't want to speak in the meeting. I thought he was going to ask me to speak. I kept running out to the toilet. I thought, oh, I don't want to speak here. And when I went out afterwards, went to a coffee shop, which had also a bar in it. I said, anyone want a drink? I was buying a lager. They went, no, you got it wrong, mate. And the lady said, the only help we can give you is recovery. And I went away thinking, my God, I've got what they've got. But I dismissed it. So when I got clean, I was obviously using in prison. And then I got clean and I come home and relapsed. But I think in prison, the spiritual awakening that I had, I'm not a name dropper, but I'd left my wife and my children and I'd met another lady. I was living in Spain and she had a restaurant and she was friends with Samantha Fox, the Page Free girl, who became a Christian at a church at Holy Trinity Brompton in Knightsbridge, the home of Alpha. And there was all things going on. It was like she come up to see me. My then wife, not the mother of my children, was Italian, very Catholic, driving me mad with prayers. But in a funny way, I always believed in God. I really did, because my grandmother was a staunch Catholic for her sins, bless her. It was all water from Lourdes. And there were so many pictures of Jesus on the wall. I thought he was a relative. You know what I mean? Very religious, very religious. Water from Lourdes. Yeah. But there was a desire. I mean, I used to pray to get the cannabis home. If Father God, if you do this, I'll never do it again. Mm. You know, and it was like, no, but that's the belief. And we was, you know, the people I was with, tough guys. But when we used to have a meeting about money or things like that, I used to say, right, all sweet, hand up to God. And they'd all go, what? I'd go, hand up to God. And anyone go, and in the end, they'd go, hand up to God. So it was always a bit of a flavour for me. But when Sam came down to the prison and she visited me with Daniela, and then we invited these people down from the church. And there was a thing called revival going on. I don't want to get into that too much. But it was something in the atmosphere, something in the air. And there was 25 guys in the chapel. I don't think I was there really to receive or expect what was about to happen. But it was a moment for me. And I can't refuse that moment. It was real. Yeah. It wasn't because I was stoned or I was looking for a way out of jail. The jail was me. I was locked away. And I got touched by a... It was like someone loved me unconditionally without speaking. Mm. And it touched that hole. I thought, my God, this is real. I was convinced it's real. I still am today. And it touched me in a place, it was like a diner rod. You know, place, my God. Listen, it didn't change me overnight. I still had this to deal with. But over the years, I've connected the heart to the head.
Which is a tough journey.
The hardest ever.
Easy to say, but I think unless you have to work on yourself and stuff and feel those changes yourself, people don't probably get what that is.
No, they don't, mate. And I tell you what, the brain pool is, I think, something, let's call it as it is, I call it the devil. But it's a playground for him. How many times you wake up in the morning and think something? You didn't choose that thought.
Well, that's what happened to me this morning. I said to you, I just woke up this morning and I had a row of negative thoughts, like, you're not good enough. And I haven't had these for a long time. You're not good enough, you're not this. And I think it's because I was tired.
Yeah.
But I think being nearly 20 years in recovery, I've kind of fortified enough to know that that's going to pass.
Amen.
Try and override it with a positive thought.
Bless you.
You know, when I did a process in a 12-step program, there was I was desperate to get rid of my thought process and the negativity. And even when I was doing really well in the modeling career, I had everything you could imagine. Coming from working class background, you know, had a place in Miami and London, lived in New York and had all the trappings. And I remember driving this car. It's an Italian sports car that I'd always desired as a kid with a supermodel. And I just wanted to cry. Oh. And I thought, what is wrong with me? Yeah. If I tell anyone like that, I could, it would make no sense. And when you're successful, like you've been really successful, you can't say to people, my life's shit, because you're living in amazing places, wearing the clothes, you've got all the friends. But that was a real turning point for me, because I thought, what is wrong with me? Seriously, what is wrong with me? And doing the 12-step program, there was a point where I'd worked with my sponsor at the time, and I went home, and I sat there. It was the weirdest thing. I'm not religious, but I asked for help.
Yeah.
And it was like, I just need to have some sort of help in my life. And for 2 days, I had silence in my head, and I wept. Mm-hmm. I literally wept. So I don't know what that spiritual experience was, what you call it.
Yeah.
And it was the first time I realized that my head's been that busy, that negative, that difficult to live with.
Oh.
And I understand a bit when you say you're in your own prison, but because people don't understand it unless you have it.
No, they don't. But you know what? Can I show you something to you? Yeah. So I'm not religious. I just believe in Jesus. And the more that I investigated who he was a tough kid, yeah? Whether anyone believes it, I'm not here to convert anyone. Yeah. But the thing I like about it is they all call it spirituality. Well, the Bible says that there's a Holy Spirit. So is the Spirit, is that what we want to be holy? Because I think the church portrays as, oh, we can't do it. We're not allowed to fart. I'm going to drop us out. Do you know what I mean? It's like, that's not the reality of it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But the healing that I've received by being around that is today I can honestly say that I function so much easier in myself that I, even talking about my tooth, I couldn't have been here without a tooth a little while. I go, it's ego, pride, mask again.
Yeah.
But I get the peace today. I haven't got it all the time. But that hole is like, it's still there, but it's not, I'm not looking to fill it with anything, but maybe love and the truth. And so that suits me. I, the truth sets us free.
And that's such a far cry, I guess, from coming from a criminal background and being, it must be difficult to be with someone like your dad who, if you read about him or, you know, he's just on the outside, just incredibly tough, smart guy, good businessman.
Yeah.
Very well connected. Does very it feel well strange connected. For you to say that about the love stuff or are you already in recovery so long that it's normal?
No, what it was my mother was a conduit of love, unconditionally. Maybe it spoilt me a lot because I think she saw that at an early age, I mean, they don't know about the abuse. She saw early days that I walked with a limp. So her three children, as much as she loved all of us, I'd be the one, I'd always be behind her leg or holding on to her. You know, I witnessed her die. It broke my heart. I loved her so much. But with Brian, my father, he had the same power of love, but he didn't have the ability to express it like my mum. He'd do anything for his kids, especially us. I mean, he has other children. But when my sister became, she got the Bachelor of Arts at Chester University, and it was the proudest moment of his life that he'd achieved something. So he had his demons and he had his things, and I'd seen him weak and vulnerable, but I didn't really realise who he was until he passed away. And he was well connected. Oh, I'm telling you, there was not one stone that, you know, I'm talking about the five families in America. I'm talking about worldwide drug importation. You know, it was a big old thing that he introduced me to, reluctantly as well. It wasn't like he didn't want me to be a criminal. But when he see I had the scars and the voice and the size, I was a good sort of front for him.
Yeah.
But he was very, he was a better criminal than I was. He was a shrewd nut. I was cavalier.
I liked it because you said in the book, which I found really fascinating, about the dialing into the phone into Amsterdam and the codes and Paris and all that stuff.
I was all mad. Mickey, Donald Duck voice.
Is that what it was?
Yeah. And it'd be, it was all, we all got nicks, so it weren't that clever.
But it sounded that way.
Yeah, it was clever.
It's funny because
it was a big importation.
Yeah.
It was a big old one. But anyway, sorry.
I was just thinking about, people talk about in recovery about hyper awareness, like super awareness. And I still have that where it used to be if I walked in a pub or a bar, I'd think who's tricky, who's scary, or what girl's there, what's going to happen. It was almost like I thought I was telepathic. You know, I think it's called paranoia now. But
absolutely.
I remember coming home from, what club was it? There was a club anyway in London, whatever, and we'd been partying all night, and I was going to drive home because I didn't like to get in cabs because I was never a criminal, but I always thought, who's the cabbie? Is he going to listen? What's going on? That. And I remember driving. I lived in North London at the time, and I remember driving. I didn't want to do a left turn in case police would see my head turn. I thought it was behind me. It was never behind me.
Wow.
And there's a guy I helped in recovery recently that was in the car that night, and he said, "You just wouldn't turn, would you? We end up going to the M25 before you turn because you're so paranoid
about
it." That's
what they should say, don't do a left.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Two lefts and it's on you.
Yeah, exactly. So I see on social media you do a lot of prison talks and prison work.
Yeah.
When I first come recovery, I did two prison talks. I swore I'd never do them again because I found it really scary.
Did you?
Yeah. Aylesbury Prison, we walked through the young offenders.
Right.
And you can, I could sense this, it like almost smell this fear in there. Mm. And the guy I was doing it with, they took us into a hut and they brought each prisoner out at a time. And I said to him, don't mention what I do for a job, like wearing makeup for a living, being a model. And the first thing he says, oh, this is Paul, he's a model. And the face has changed, that's the forces coming in. And what really struck me was it felt really intense and really scary, but they appreciated the chair and appreciated me coming in. And when they got taken off one by one, there was two guys left, and they asked if they could have a word. And what struck me was the kid really opened up, and he said, "I couldn't speak when everyone else is here. It was too, you know, because I'd caused problems."
Right.
But he said, "I think he'd killed someone drinking and driving." And then he explained that most of the people in there were in there because of drink and drugs in some way, shape or form, whether they're buying and selling all that stuff.
Was it young offenders?
Yes. Why do you go back in prisons and help people? What do you feel the need to do that for, and how do you find that?
Well, we only keep what we got by giving it away. You know what, before I answer that question, you surprised me. Because I identify with a lot you're saying.
Mm.
We had the same sort of dad, we had the same whatever, the fear and all that. But you never expose that. You never, in meetings I heard you share it, but the reality of you was, you know what you was and who you was with and all that sort of thing. So there was a glamour that you never expressed the glamour because you're pretty cool about it. It was always cool. So to hear you speak like this, you hid it well. I'm glad you don't hide it no more because it's cancerous. It'll take us out. It's bad stuff. So why do I go in prisons? I feel really at home there, Paul. I love it. I've just finished a 6 weeks recovery course in Pentonville with 18 guys. Two of them I knew from back in the day. And it helps me to think, wow, you know, we're delivering a message of truth because they're locked away. They need the key to the safe to get out. And so I enjoy that. I mentor them when they come out. I've done a few of them who've come out of prison. And I'm nothing special. I speak from my own experiences. But it's something that we do Alpha in prisons, which is a worldwide Christian thing that's gone everywhere. I mean, it was a guy. Do you mind if I explain this next
one? No, please do, please.
When I found my faith, when I explained earlier, So it started a course. So an Alpha course is an introduction to Christianity, yeah? And we started it in the prisons in 1994. And it went everywhere. It went to all the British prisons, to America, South America, Africa. And I've been to these places since I've been home, into the prisons out there. And you think our prisons are tough. Drop me out. You want to go to a Nick in Uganda? It's naughty, mate. There's a cell where it's just, the prison was meant to have 800 people in it, had 6,000. Imagine the smell and how they were. And so I'd seen it all, but a few years ago, and I'm not blowing my own trumpet, but there's a guy called Nicky Gumbel. He's a great guy. He's a friend of mine. And he led one of the biggest movements of this Alpha course and Christianity. And what I like about it, he ain't religious. He's so far not religious. And so when the course started in the prisons, a little while ago, well, about 5 or 6 years ago, they asked me to talk at the Albert Hall. Which I did. I enjoyed it. It was about 6,000 people there. I didn't find it I found it a little bit nerve-wracking at the beginning. But when you start to share the truth, the ego goes. It's really comes from that brokenness that's been healed, if that makes sense.
100%, yeah.
So prior to the going on talking at the Albert Hall, there was a workshop at the church in Knightsbridge at Holy Trinity Brompton. There's celebrities in there. There's the poor. There's the homeless. There's all groups in there, and it's community. It's wonderful children in there. You couldn't go in there and not enjoy it. You don't think you're in a church, and it's like it's not like Catholicism, is that? Yeah. And not knocking that.
So is it spiritual based?
Yeah, it's really cool. And it's biblical based, but they understand. Mm. You know, they understand. So I'm in the church prior to doing the Albert Hall. And it was an African guy from Uganda. Yeah. And I'm not knocking him because I got friends out there. But he had the shiniest pair of maroon trousers on and this sort of green shirt, which was like, whatever it was, and he had these funny shoes. And I'm sorry to say that, but it's the truth. And then Nicky interviewed him, and he was unbelievable. So he says this guy. He got sentenced to death over a military coup. He was on death row for 23 years.
Wow.
Right? So I'm listening to the guy. He said, and I looked out of my cell one day. I looked out of my cell. And he said, you know a couple of people on this sign as well. It's a printed sign of a few of us who'd come to know the Lord, let's just say. So he went and done the course. They took him off of death row. It's true. Took him off of death row. And they gave him his job back in the Ugandan government as the prison ministry. And as he's talking, I thought, my God, I was there at the beginning. 20-odd years have elapsed, and there's this man. You know, if I didn't start it, someone else would. So I'm not looking for the pat on the back. But it's quite an incredible story.
Yeah.
And I thought, wow, something's worked. So they're the other reasons I go in there. And when I was sharing at the Albert Hall, one of the words that I said was, the curse has been broken. And it has been broken because the sin of the father of my grandfather who committed suicide, very violent man, bless his heart. They know not what they do. My dad, broken man, me. And I never had any sons. And I'm grateful I never had any. Listen, they were difficult, my girls, but I never had any sons. So that genetic value doesn't exist in the masculine line. I've got 6 grandsons, and I've watched them very... I've got 8 grandchildren, and I watch my grandsons very carefully, and I do not... One or two of them are a little bit lively, but they're all lovely school-educated. I've been blessed with these kids, and I don't see that germ of destruction coming out of them, so I'm grateful for that. So I do believe the curse has been broken.
It's interesting that you say that, because I read a number of years ago about that when you come into recovery and you find yourself, that you break 7 generations of addiction if you stay. I don't know how true that is. I know Gabor Mate talks about it.
Mm.
But I kind of feel similar.
Yeah, so do I.
From my dad's line and my granddad, he was an alcoholic and a gambler and gambled houses away and stuff. And just, it was, I really tried to get to know him towards the end.
Who, your dad?
No, my grandfather. So my dad's dad. Because my dad had a really tough upbringing. He was, you know,
yeah,
beaten and all sorts of stuff. And he was taken away. He said that he was taken away three times, one for the war and then twice to a convalescent home because he was hungry and unwell and whatnot. So he was the only one on the bus waving goodbye, thinking, thank God he's getting out of here.
And they
took him out to a place called Frining in Essex, where the guy who ran it was an old military guy and taught my dad how to eat properly. They used to have raw vegetables, meat once a week. But he taught my dad how to train physically.
Right.
And then became a bodybuilder way back in, I think it was in the 60s or whatever.
Your dad?
My dad, when it first came around.
Wow.
Yeah. And he won't never say this, he's quite a humble guy, but my mum showed me pictures and he was on the stage with Arnold Schwarzenegger when he first started.
Oh, wow.
And stuff like that, yeah. But he's never, I found his gold medals in a tray once.
And
I was
never
like,
mentioned it.
No, he won't. He's like totally.
That's wonderful, though, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah, he's completely like that. So it's funny when you spoke about your dad because I've always wanted a cuddle from my dad. And the only time I ever got one was when I was coming out the Priory and I asked him, and it was like cuddling a bit of concrete. Oh. It was so uncomfortable. So now I realise I was pushing him out of his comfort zone. But now I realise a handshake with my dad is the same as a cuddle.
Amen.
You know what I mean?
You've upset me. I identify big time.
Yeah.
Bless their hearts, eh?
Yeah, it's funny, but I realised I was quite selfish in the beginning because I just wanted to have something for my dad. Mm-hmm. And I realised he's a doer. You know, he's eight odd years of age. And a little while ago, something happened in my car, had a puncture or whatever. He goes, I'll be there.
Yeah, great.
He's like that. Yeah. You know, do it. He won't say stuff, but he'll do it and be there.
My dad,
you know,
is the same.
Yeah.
Loyal to the days. They love their children. When I look at, there's so much identification here, you know, and I knew bits of your story, but it's compelled me to think, my God, he's talking about me and my dad. And my dad was the same. And I saw my younger brother. Do you mind me talking about this?
No, please do.
In 1984 or 1985, I was in a car chase with the police with a friend of mine who passed away.
Was that here, Mike, or was that in Spain?
In the UK.
Yeah.
And he was wanted by the police, and we was in a car together. Something had happened. There was a bit of whatever had happened, but they wanted him badly. He was a tough kid, yeah? And we got chased by the police, helicopters, police and everything. We had this mad getaway. And we wind up driving into a wall that was hid behind a fence, about 60, 70 miles. We was going fast. In the mental home at Tooting. Quite apparently, it was quite weird, really.
Trying
to get in there. You know what I mean? So, bump was in. He went through the window screen. I wound up busting my knee and my ankle in a wheelchair in Brixton Prison. Yeah. Anyway, one thing led to another. I had a bit of fortune. I get out on bail, and because they didn't really want me, there was stuff in the car that they hadn't found. They found it afterwards, and it was full because the car was smashed to pieces. It was like half its size. Anyway, I left and I went to live in Marbella because that's where all the chaps were. You know, the likes of Foreman, Freddie Foreman, lovely man. And down I go with the influence of my dad. Make sure he's looked after and from love, not from intimidation. So I go down there, I get bang at it. I'm only, how old was I? 24, I think, 25. I got bang at it. I loved it.
It was a good period down there, though.
It was fantastic. And it was very romantic there as well. It's not like it is today. And so I was there, and my brother came over to see me because my grandfather on my mother's side was dying. Two very special men, my grandfather John Watkins and my brother Martin, who's Helen's. You know Helen? You follow Helen?
Yeah.
So she's the mother of his son. He never met his son. His son was born before, he passed away tragically. So we was in Spain and we used cocaine. He never used to use it a lot. He wasn't really that way inclined. We had an argument, yeah? And he took the car. I mean, he walked away. Portman was boring. And it was early hours of the morning. I went and found him, give him the car. I took him home. He then sneaks out the house, takes the car, gets to Malaga Airport. On the way home, he gets, he goes underneath the lorry and it kills him stone dead. Yeah. So it enhanced the whole.
Mm.
And then we sort of buried, my grandfather died 2 days later. So my mum buried her son and her dad on the same day. Two very wonderful men, yeah. But where I was down there, that influence of my dad and things like that, I forget your question. What was the question?
It doesn't matter. I'm loving the story.
Okay. So we forget the question. Yeah. So there I am. And I get woken up the following day and we can't find my brother. So I phone up the UK and I say, he's dead, isn't he? And they say, yeah. So he couldn't find me for hours. So I thought, my God. Helen was 3 months pregnant with Charles, who's a beautiful boy today. He missed a bullet. He was fortunate. He never had, because my brother never had the madness. Thank God.
Which is why I think it is a genetic component, right?
Very much so. It is. And this is from experience, not from textbooks or the doctor telling me or God, yeah. Whatever. This is from experience. I can only speak from experience. And so there I was in this sort of vacuum of gangsters and what I thought was, wow, always frightened. Not them, but frightening me. I don't know what it was about.
Mm.
And so I came back to the UK to bury my brother and my grandfather. I was wanted by the police. And the addiction spiraled out of control.
Because of the pain of that, do you think?
Oh, I was in terrible pain, Paul. And it started... I don't want to call them affairs because these women were human beings, but it started my, whether it came from the childhood abuse, no excuse, I take responsibility for it, but I had two crazy affairs with people very close to me. It was wrong what I'd done, but I was driven by this thing because I hated who I was. I hated the way I felt. And Martin's death was naughty, yeah, for me. I went to prison, came home. Left my wife and my children, went to live in Spain again. So it started, the spiral of destruction. And I was in it to win it. I had to kill it. I had to kill myself. I had to do this. Everything I'd done with a dear friend of ours who you know I won't mention, you know, it was insane what I'd done.
Mm.
It was like doing it to myself. Not forget the business, but we had a business involved here. We had a friendship that could have never been broken. And yet the demon got me and I'd done what I'd done, as you know. I'm not proud of that. I really am not proud of that. But it's not kind, it's cunning and baffling. It ain't our friend.
It's funny because for people who don't know about addiction and stuff, there's a component which is an obsessive thought process. An obsessive thought means that's the only one you can hear, see, and you have to go for it. And it's kind of going for it to take away the anxiety. Mm. And this is experience as well. And you can't really read about that. I've read some books about addiction that touch on it. But when my mother's father died when I was 19, he was I looked up at him as my hero. He was out of Hackney, 13 brothers. He had two died in the war, one died in Hackney Wick. But he was awarded the George Cross.
Oh, wow.
And a little bit like your mum and dad. My mum was wonderful, yeah, and loving, and he was like that. He was a man's man, never spoke about the war, never told us he had a George Cross.
Oh, wow.
Really lovely. Just looked after his two daughters, which was my mum and her sister. And I always had this thing that I wanted to impress him and help him and, yeah, stuff. And when he died, something happened to me. I was so hurt and didn't know what to do. But I was like, just whatever. And I went off on the rampage.
How old was that.
I was 19 at the time.
Oh, right, 19, sorry.
And before I became a model at 21, I was buying and selling motorbikes. We was driving cars and cutting them up for money in the scrapyard down in Raynham. We was doing all those things.
As you
and
do.
all I wanted to do was earn money. And the only appreciation I felt like I got from my dad was when I did well. Yeah. And by the time I think I was 15, I bought my sister her first car. Right. I was doing all right. And I thought, I'm all right here. This is, you know, but it didn't last long.
Oh, no.
Because when I found a drink and drugs, it just messed everything up.
Yeah.
But I understand I was doing a play, funny enough, up the road, and my acting coach, Tom Ratcliffe, is in recovery. I went there, I was probably a year sober when I went there, and I really wanted to find myself. And I went to this acting school, did this scene, and Tom stopped me halfway through and he said, I want you to be really emotional. You're supposed to be basically hanging off this girl's ankles. And it was a Clifford Odette play. The kid was a boxer and a violinist, and he fell in love with the boxing promoter's wife, which is always a mistake. And I really went into this part because I really wanted to be good. But I couldn't cry. He said, what's wrong? And I stood up on stage and I went, I've never cried. I've always had two girlfriends at once. And the girls went, oh, don't be so flash. And I burst out crying. And I went, I've just had an epiphany. It wasn't because I was a player. It's because I was so scared of being on my own. I needed a guarantee, not to put the ladies down, by the way, but I needed something there.
Wow.
And I felt that void and that weakness of, why can't I be on my own?
Wow.
What is that about? And that came through doing a play. So I made mistakes like what you said about...
Are you talking about me?
And at the time I thought, oh, you're being crafty, you're being smart, you're being this. And I'd keep girls' phone numbers under restaurant names and different names and whatever, and made these stories. And I was convincing myself that I was doing well and this is how you're supposed to do things. But it was so shallow and left me so hollow.
Bless you.
That when I first come into recovery, I wouldn't advise this to anyone, by the way, but I did a whole year of not texting a girl. I wouldn't look at them on the tube. I wouldn't do anything, wouldn't just on my own.
Did you abstain from intimacy?
100% for a year. And I cried quite a lot in the beginning, weirdly, because I realised only by doing the opposite how much I relied on other people to make me feel good.
Ooh.
And I felt, therefore, you're giving your power to everybody. Because if you phone someone they don't phone back, you get angry about it. How do you do that? I didn't understand. I was quite jealous as a teenager. I didn't understand the toolkit. So I abstained completely for a year and I found that I was okay in my own company. It took about 6 months to realise and I stopped all the temptations and it was really amazing to see how much I was, could call it addicted to relationships or reliant on other people. Wow. And for me, that was one powerful thing and it stands me in good stead today, you know.
That's priceless what you've done. And I tell you what, anyone listening, that's priceless. So it's all about abstinence.
Yeah.
And it allows something to go on that desire is not cunning. That was wonderful what you just said. And I identify what a cunning illness this is. And
yeah, it really does.
It's bad, isn't it, really, when we act out on it. But the way forward, like you just said, is to be abstinent. And something else grows, that dependency for self. We become self-efficient and we start to like ourselves a little bit, but we have to be careful.
We do, but that's
I think
the
your
key.
Marriage is your making. Sorry, but I do.
Yeah, no, I'm very fortunate to marry a girl who actually likes me for me and I like her.
Oh, how wonderful.
Yeah, that was I think that was quite an interesting moment when I met my missus, though. I was in tune enough. That's the bit I think about absence that people don't realise, that the only way really you find something is by stopping it, because then you can see the opposite or the effects that it have.
Amen.
Or the temptations and the thought process.
Absolutely.
Otherwise, you're just running around doing the same thing, wondering why I can't do it.
Absolutely.
And blaming the other person for, you know. Yeah. A good friend of mine used to say, I used to phone up my girlfriend to see how I felt.
That's true. It's a man, isn't it? Isn't it insane?
Yeah.
What that desire is, first of all, if they don't answer, I'm in trouble, yeah? Or if they don't say what I want to hear, I'm in trouble. Well, it's not so much like that now.
Yeah.
But if I'm not careful, if I'm not looking after myself, if I'm not being true to myself, if I'm looking for a fix, because my ego wants, oh, crap. then I can go back to that self-loathing, but I have the ability to slip out of it. It's a thought. That's why the heart and the brain is important. Because I feel God gave us a brain to learn, but we want to work out emotion. It's not emotional, the brain. It's like a computer. The emotion's the heart. So to connect it, people used to say, "Oh, speak from your heart," or "Listen to your heart." And I'd try and listen. What are they talking about? I didn't have the ability to love, and I think that's where I was full of love, and that was where my frustration lied. I didn't need you to like me. I wanted to love you, but I overextended the crap that addiction brings. Now, if we switch it and we begin to heal it, then the drive of the addict, let's not call it the addict, the drive of desire to achieve rather than desire to show you my ego and my pride, the desire to achieve becomes something that the addict can be comfortable with as long as it's not over the top. And that drive can be positive, but if the drive is allowed to put a bit of coke up our trumpet or a drink or look at a pretty girl, then it's obsessive, like you said.
Yeah.
And it's very, very damaging, and it takes years to recover from that.
It is incredible because I was reading something a little while ago.
I think you should be a therapist.
Do you like to lay down on my couch? Well, you know, I coach. I'm a mindset coach. I trained in COVID as a mindset coach.
Well, I didn't know that.
Yeah, man. I took, we did like 130 hours of NLP training, 130 hours of timeline therapy. We did lots of stuff. So I do coach people.
But you deliver it with peace. I like that. It's very calm.
When you've had that chaotic head, which again is until you step out of it or can see it, it's nuts because everything's 100 miles an hour and you can see it in people. You probably can do it. I can spot an addict a mile away.
Absolutely.
100% from their behavior, what they're doing. It was weird. When I was in treatment, there was an amazing therapist called Patty and we did art class. And we did music therapy, and I thought, I can sing in the music therapy. And this woman was doing Sanskrit chanting, and it was Jay. She was singing something like Jay Bhagavan, so we was calling it Jay's Burger Van, right? And she let us, for two lessons, she let us sing Jay's Burger Van. And the reason being, she said, because you are happy, you're laughing. Oh. Even though you think you're taking the mickey out of me, she goes, it's wonderful to see.
Yeah, wonderful.
And when she said that, we all stopped. Yeah. Exactly what she said, because we respected her for
Amen.
It. And it became really cathartic. Yeah. I never thought I'd be singing with a group of fellas about Sanskrit, you know.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And in the art class, again, I thought, why am I doing art? What's that got to do with anything? But I realised that whilst I was focusing on drawing and colouring in, I wasn't thinking about drink or drugs how do I get out of this treatment centre or any of my problems, and it broke that thought chain.
Amen.
So I realised that certain things can break a chain.
Mine's cooking.
Is it?
Yeah, I love to cook.
When I was young. When I come around for dinner.
Yeah, you can more than welcome to come any time you like. And it was a way of me, and I used to think after an hour, I love the preparation. And I thought, my God, I haven't thought about anything. I listen to a man sometimes, called Eckhart Tolle. You know him?
Eckhart Tolle, yeah. I listened to him, just quickly, when I lived in LA for a year, every night on CD, because I couldn't sleep.
Wow. It's an amazing message.
Yeah.
The message is nothing. It's about not thinking. And you think, what do you mean, not thinking? And it takes practice. But when we have the ability, anyone in the room, you say, don't think for a minute. It's blinking hard.
Yeah.
That's why we don't choose our thoughts. But when we start to train the brain not to think, 10 seconds, 20 seconds, 30 seconds, it gives the alignment of the body and the heart to speak. And people go, oh, shut up, you soppy. Because of ego, pride, no one wants to. That's why I think we're important. The society needs to understand that we're all barking mad. Whether you're the prime minister or whatever you are, this world is insane. Driven by greed, power, and I'm really anti governments because they call us criminals and they're bang at it.
Yeah.
they reduce the population by a war, they do this, whatever they do. So I don't vote for what? I don't vote or anything like that. I don't agree with it because I know that every human being is controlled by fear, power, ego if they're not looking at what's right. Mm. I'm sorry, that's my opinion. But Eckhart Tolle gave me the ability to go, and I started to like it. I thought, my God, I ain't thinking. Stinking thinking. And eventually I think it's another part of recovery that the brain needs to heal.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the brain needs to. As you know, I've got cancer at the moment. Do you mind me mentioning that?
No.
You don't mind?
No, I just feel bad that you have. But
I know. But there's another bit of love in that for me. It's made me. I got diagnosed 2 years ago. I was in a treatment center doing some work. I come up in a lift and I had a big bald patch and my barnet and my teeth were the two things I loved. I didn't like my belly. I always had a beer belly, but my barnet and my teeth. And I've got like the size of that, Mike. I got a hole in me. I thought, what's that? I crap myself. I went and had tests, blah, blah, blah. They couldn't find nothing. Then I caught COVID when I was meant to have my lungs tested. And eventually I got up there. They said I was in trouble. I never told anybody the severity of it. I didn't want to upset my kids. But after 8 months of intense treatment, not only me, loads of people go through this, so I'm not waving the brave flag, but I heard my heart speak and my mind stopped digging me out. It was quite bizarre. And I had 9-hour drips on the chemo. I called it the chemo club. It was crazy up there. I got them all dancing and that was short-lived, I hasten to add, because once the treatment kicks in. And then I got all clear from it. I got the all clear. And then they made a bit of an error. The lady said it's gone to my brain. Then the other person, they didn't go that way. And then 5 months later, they say it's in my brain. So I was 5 months, I could have had more treatment. And I was on this treatment. I was doing very well. And then 4 weeks ago, my eye started playing me up. And they say it's spiked, size of a piece of rice. And I went to them the other day. They want me to have chemo in my brain. And I'm thinking about going, whatever, I got thoughts about it. And I said to the guy, I said, look, he's a professional, man. I said, look, I know that you're here doing your job and whatever. I said, but it's one thing that determines my life, and it's not you or the radiation. It's my timescale in life with the God I believe in, and he determines the days of my life. Now, I wouldn't have been able to be like that in other circumstances, but it's sort of another part of my deliverance of my healing because I've had to accept the reality that I could die. I ain't going to. And it doesn't freak me out. We've all got a past, but I do not think for 1 minute that I'm about to pass away. Now, my children don't know about, it doesn't matter, you publicise what you want, but my kids don't know I've got it in my brain, yeah? But they're off smelling it, my girls. But I don't want to tell them because I think I'm going to live. Mm. And that is through recovery, God, and my heart speaking. I won't agree with it. I won't have it. I just won't have it. I've lost railings. I've lost free. I've done about. I always wanted to be slim like you.
I'm not slim.
So I've done about 15 kilo in weight, but I thought, well, what difference makes? What difference? Who cares what you look like, really, when you're in this situation? But I believe in a God that's healing, and I believe we self-medicate with the truth.
I totally believe that.
Amen.
I really believe that, and mate, I wish you all the best with that.
I know you do, bro.
Just quickly, I ask everyone, to our listeners, if someone's struggling with addiction or alcoholism or a family member, what advice would you give them to find out, or where would they go?
Right, it's a wonderful question. I think there's a thing called rock bottom, desperation, and we cry out to heroin, coke, drink, in that desperation. But I think if we get brought to our knees, a number of times it brings us to our knees, but we don't react. We go back down the pub or we get on the phone and get a bit more gear. But my advice is, as painful as it may seem, it's a lot less painful getting clean than continuing. But we can't underestimate the powers that this illness brings. And it's a spiritual illness, in my opinion. So my advice would be go online, go to a meeting. It's not religion. Don't get bogged up in that. Or speak to someone like-minded. There's always someone out there. The Bible says that iron sharpens iron. It helps us. And I just feel that to embrace love and to love ourselves, but we hate ourselves because of the behaviour that active addiction can bring. So my advice is to be kind to yourself. You know, self-medicate yourself with love. And trust is a difficult one. And get around like people like yourself, like-minded people who've come a long way in their journey. And I've seen your journey, and I have total respect for you. And I think the journey of the addict, once they get clean, because we're tough, we've had to be, resilient, not out of choice, out of circumstances. And I think once we realise that we are can do this one day at a time. When they first told me when I come into recovery, it's one day at a time. I thought, whoa, 24 years ago, one day at a time, leave me out. But it works, it's successful. And I've been taking alternative drugs as well with this treatment. I've done that CBD, that stuff, and, you know, cannabis. I was one of the biggest cannabis smugglers in the UK. And now I'm taking it because it's... And I went to prison for it. I went to prison for healing. But so my advice is reach out.
Yeah.
And you won't be hurt, and trust.
Amen. Thanks, Michael. I'll leave it on that. It's been amazing. Thank you so much.
Oh, I've really enjoyed myself. Bless you, Paul.
Cheers, mate.
Bless you, sir.
This podcast is brought to you by Stride Foundation. If you or someone you know is struggling with addiction, please head over to www.stridefoundation.com where you can find links to resources that may help. You can also make a donation. Please make a donation. It will help us bring to you more episodes. And if you enjoyed This Is Powerful, please rate, review, and follow the podcast to share it with your friends, your family, anyone you can, and head over to social media. I always love to see and hear how you react to the episodes, and it's so helpful for our content to be shared. A huge thank you to Michael today, and if you want to check out his book or anything more about him, please check the show notes. Thank you also to my beautiful wife, Dr. Federica and Marty, the best producer, Shannon Delwich, to Henry, you know who you are, and to Emma Long, who does all the hard work in the background. And there's a whole catalogue of episodes wherever you get your podcasts. But did you know you can also watch it on YouTube? Just search for This Is Powerful with Paul Scholford.